Ancient Amber Roots. Travels from Riga to Byzantium by Mara Kalninch. This book is the record of an odyssey, a journey of exploration which begins in Latvia, the homeland of my parents. Its purpose is to learn about the culture, history, and origins of the Baltic peoples, whose survival over 8 centuries of conquest by one great power after another is little short of miraculous. The quest is focused by the defining symbol of the Balts, amber, the sunstone, the stone of light, a substance which has danced in and out of the European imagination since prehistoric times. In antiquity, all peoples desired amber, not only for its beauty, but because it was thought to be the substance of the sun itself, and so possessed magical properties. It could heal. It was a talisman against the dark. It was considered the most powerful of amulets, and many legends were told about it and its mysterious origins. My journey was shaped by 2 of the principal long-distance amber trade routes, which for millennia linked the Baltic with the rest of the continent and with the cradles of civilization in the Mediterranean. As I explored the amber lands and traveled south and east across the changing face of Europe, I also journeyed back in time to make some remarkable discoveries about amber and about the people who preserved their ancient heritage and language and brought them into the 21st century. What follows are a few extracts from that journey. Part 1, The Amber Lands. From Chapter 3, The Amber Museum. 50 million years ago, there was dry land where the present Baltic seabed lies, an early continent named Fennoscandia. It was here that a certain species of pine flourished and secreted an unusual type of resin. Over millions of years of geological change and upheaval, the land sank to be replaced by sea, and the resin became compacted and was laid down in thin strata 2 or 3 feet thick, rather like coal. This fossilized substance is Baltic amber, or succinite, so called because it contains a high percentage of succinic acid, which gives it its brilliance and gem-like quality. The particularly fragrant and sticky resin also attracted insects, which became trapped and preserved as the resin solidified. There are many types of fossilized resin all over the world, but it is Baltic amber that has been the source material over the ages for 90% of the artifacts made of amber. And the finest still comes from the coast, extending from southern Latvia and Lithuania down to the Jutland Peninsula. In the popular imagination, amber is synonymous with a warm, golden color, but it can occur naturally in many hues, depending on the impurities that have been absorbed by the resin. Amber ranges from ivory through all the shades of yellow and red, a color particularly prized by the Romans, to the deep brown of a rich sherry. Very occasionally, there is amber so dark as to be almost black, and there's the equally rare green amber, and, rarest of all, blue amber. The magnificent Amber Museum at Palanga, Lithuania, is set in a fine landscaped park of some 500 acres and is approached by a long carriage drive which curves past ornamental lakes and ponds, gardens and woods, skirting a mound called Birutes Hill, where rituals were held in pagan times. The visitor who ascends the grand double sweep of the external steps to the entrance on the piano nobile, however, is hardly prepared for the scale of the treasures and the wonders that will be revealed within. For this museum presents nothing less than the entire history of amber, from its natural formation to the finest examples of contemporary amber art and jewelry. The first few rooms alone leave one dumbstruck at the sheer wealth of the exhibitions. Hundreds of pieces of amber are displayed in brilliantly illuminated cases in which large oval magnifying lenses have been set, so that plants, flowers, seeds, pollen grains, insects shine out with remarkable clarity and sharpness. These are truly windows onto time itself, caught and frozen at a single moment 50 million years ago. Spacious room follows spacious room, as yet more exhibits unfold. Over 1,000 items of world-class quality are on show at any one time. And I was told that the vaults contain another 14,000 pieces of equal importance. It is a naturalist's paradise. However, I had not been drawn here by the reputation of the amber inclusions, but by the chance to see the originals of the famous Mesolithic and Neolithic amber figurines and solar disks, which I had found reproduced in archaeological and anthropological journals. What I could not have foreseen was the extraordinary impact these humanoid figures would have in reality. It was a masterstroke of the curators to set them in cases on the wall at eye level, so that they catch the eye as soon as the visitor enters the room and seem to gaze back at one. The display includes several figures varying in shade from light yellow to a deep honey amber. And they appear to fall into two kinds. There are heads, some with rather knobbly features, as if the artist had used the natural curves and contours of the amber to allow the face within to emerge. Intuitively, one feels that these homely portraits may have represented actual individuals, real people in the tribes. Then there are the larger figures, beautifully crafted pieces whose heads flow gracefully from smoothly sculpted torsos. One or two of these are recognizably masculine in feature and form. Chieftains or deities, perhaps. But the largest and most striking figure, with a suggestion of a garment, a sculpted fold hanging to one side, like the edge of a shawl or a toga, with its elegant triangular face, level eyes, thin nose, and pointed chin, is surely female. Could this be a priestess, perhaps, or a representation of the great mother goddess herself? The serene, enigmatic faces seem to gaze back and to whisper in unknown tongues from the other side of a dense forest of time. Part 2, River, Land, and Sea. From Chapter 5, Nero's Monocle. Imagine the view from the International Space Station, balanced on its orbit above the blue globe, the continents and oceans rolling past in stately procession. From this perspective, The boundaries of nations are as ephemeral as the cloud masses that form, dissolve, and reform. And it is the geographical features that take on prominence. Let the eye track slowly across Europe, and soon the principal routes that have determined the histories of civilizations and the movements of migrating peoples become clear. The river systems, spreading like a delicate fan of nerves across the continental landmass and mountain ranges, at this height reduced to crinkled fabric, threaded by tiny access passes and valleys. It comes as a shock to realize that these are the great massifs of the Alps, the Carpathians, and the Balkans, which form the vast barrier dividing northern Europe from the southern lands, bordering the Adriatic, Ionian, Aegean, and Black Seas. From this altitude, the ebb and flow of tribal migrations and the choice of continental and sea routes make perfect sense. In historical times, the golden age of the amber trade and the consolidation of its north-south routes coincided roughly with the time of the Roman Empire, though the routes themselves had been in use since the Neolithic period. The Romans prized amber of all hues and esteemed the palette of honey colors, but their particular love was for the glowing translucence of a certain fiery but soft shade of red, like a clear Falernian wine. The single most conspicuous example of Roman passion for this gem resulted in a journey that has become legendary. The expedition of Julianus to the unknown north of the world, sent thither to procure enough amber to satisfy the craving of the last of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, the Emperor Nero. It is to Pliny the Elder that we owe an account of this great adventure in Roman commerce. And I quote, "There is still living a member of the equestrian order who was sent thither by Julianus, the manager of the gladiatorial exhibitions for the Emperor Nero, to procure a supply of this article. Traversing the coasts of that country and visiting the various markets there, he brought back amber in such vast quantities that the nets, which were used for protecting the podium against the wild beasts, were studded with amber. The arms, the litters, and all the other apparatus were for one day decorated with nothing but amber, a different kind of display being made each day that these spectacles were exhibited. The largest piece of amber was 13 pounds in weight." This expedition set out sometime in the second half of Nero's reign, probably after the Great Fire of AD 64, following which the circus was extensively rebuilt and games of unrivaled extravagance staged. It is said that the expedition returned with several hundred pounds of amber, and such a quantity would certainly have been needed if we are to believe Pliny's report, for the repaired circus seated 200,000, and the nets studded with amber would have had to encircle the entire arena, protecting spectators in the lower tiers from wild animals. Irrespective of the actual amount brought back, however, this was no haphazard journey of trial and error across unknown territories, but an expedition which followed a route so well established that a large mule train could follow it safely and the distance be calculated with considerable precision, using one of the Roman milometers, which discharged their pebbles at calibrated intervals as they were pulled along. This is a very different matter from the picture of a dark, barbarous continent threaded by a few hazardous trails. Consider for a moment what Julianus's knight would have required. Riding animals for himself and his entourage. Many more to carry the trade goods out and amber back. And still more for provisions and tents. So ambitious an undertaking could not have proceeded cross-country on an ad hoc basis, but would have been carefully planned beforehand, using the network of local roads and tracks which would have interconnected to form the Amber Way. Contacts with trustworthy local guides would have been essential. Their expertise would have been needed to negotiate fodder for the animals, as well as to locate river fords and to negotiate the marshy areas of East Prussia. Now, these last were traversed over primitive marsh bridges, made of layers of logs across which boards, fastened with pegs, were placed. They were like rough boardwalks, with poles on either side to stabilize them, built and maintained by the local population, and some were over 1,000 meters long. Apparently, as a bridge slowly settled over time and needed to be elevated, another layer was added. In some locations, there are bridges of 6 layers and more. They remained in place for hundreds of years after Rome's passing. As late as the 10th century, the merchant traveler Ibrahim ibn Yaqub described such marsh bridges on his way from the coast to Prague. And recent carbon dating of their remains confirms that they were built originally in the first 6 or 7 centuries BC, so they would certainly have been well established by Nero's time. Part 3, Between Earth and Sky, from Chapter 7, Along the Viking Road. Now we embark on the Great Eastern Amber Route in a fresh voyage of exploration, traveling ever further back in time as we traverse the vast eastern borderlands of Europe to Byzantium. In historical times, the river route linking the Baltic and Black Seas was known as the Viking Road to Mikkelgard, and Viking ships navigated the Daugava River well into Belarus, where, after a series of interfluvial portages, they joined the Dnieper River and continued south to the island of Berezon at the mouth of the river on the Black Sea. After that, it was a comparatively easy matter to hug the western seashore, skirting what would become modern Odessa, past the Dniester and Danube deltas, ever southwards to the Bosphorus and Byzantium. But long before the Norse ships plied this lucrative trade route, the legend of a waterway connecting the Black Sea with the Northern Ocean had been known to the classical world. In the 5th century BC, Herodotus wrote about it and of the tribes who lived there. Excavations of much earlier Bronze Age burial sites also confirm that amber and other precious goods and metals had formed the staple of trade between the northern peoples and those of the Pontic and Mediterranean cultures for thousands of years before the travels and writings of the Greek historian. Earlier still, it had been along these very riverlands that around 2500 BC, a tribe of Indo-Europeans had migrated north and west to establish themselves at last in the Baltic. and recent linguistic evidence is in accord with contemporary archaeological findings in suggesting that the Dnieper and Don river basins, a portion of the great forest steppe and plains of the Black and Caspian Sea region, was also part of the original homeland of the Proto-Indo-Europeans. It was immensely exciting to think that following the fortunes of the Sunstone would also lead me to retrace the unimaginably distant migration paths of the peoples from whom the rich diversity of languages and cultures of modern Europe have sprung. The Daug of a river, whose length bisects the entire country from Riga to the easternmost boundary of Latvia with Belarus, is known locally as the River of Fate and the River of Souls. Rivers have always been central to the imagination, the places where dreams and aspirations take form. We visualize their flow as a universal metaphor for time and for the journey from birth to death. They symbolize the lifeblood of a people, nature's bounty, the wealth of commerce, the boundaries of kingdoms and empires, and above all, that sense of a shared cultural heritage which shows itself in the desire for political autonomy. One thinks of Smetana's famous tone poem, which follows the Vltava River from its birth in the Tatras Mountains through the woods and fields of Bohemia, becoming in its journey a symbol of the Czech people who had yet to achieve the status of nationhood. Or, in a transcontinental context, the Danube, an imperial ribbon, as one historian has called it, binding together the diverse peoples of the Habsburg Empire, Teuton, Slav, Magyar. The Daugava performs a similar function and is celebrated in hundreds of Latvian songs and stories. Our plan was to follow the Daugava across the eastern border into Belarus as far as Vitebsk, and then continue across the country to Russian Smolensk and the nearby archaeological site of Gniezhnevo on the Dnieper. It was here that I hoped to find traces of the Viking portage between the two rivers. Part of this legendary route was attempted in 2001, when the Eyfor, a small Scandinavian vessel, sailed from the Gulf of Riga to Vitebsk, but with only limited success, for the river levels were low that summer. It was an exhilarating thought, however, to imagine that one day a fully reconstructed, dragon-proud Viking ship may recreate the whole of that epic journey from the Baltic to Byzantium. If you have enjoyed these extracts and would like to know more about my travels along the ancient Amber routes and to share some of the adventures and discoveries, the book will be available from Peter Gailis Press in Riga, Latvia, from 2013, a year before the city becomes the cultural capital of Europe.